So today is Tuesday, October 10th, 2017, and we're welcoming Senior Tier Guard Instructors Miocin Kelly and Tim Olmsted to the Waitara webinar. Greetings. Oh, Tim, we can't hear you.
Okay. So thanks, Diane. And thanks, Max, in the background. And good evening, Miocin. And this is our first Waitara webinar, so welcome to everybody. And Diane said I was a senior instructor, and as I look at myself on the screen, that it's really clear. So this is one of the reasons it's great to practice Waitara, because you imagine yourself to be something other than you actually are. Anyway, so usually we start webinars like this with a few comments. And I don't have a lot to say, and Miocin will offer some thoughts, except that, you know, in my case, I've practiced sadhana practice, deity practice for 35 years. And I think theoretically I've gotten a lot of teachings on sadhana practice, and I can't say that I remember very much about it, but I can say that one of the beauties of practicing in this way is that you really are doing something. It's as if you think about playing basketball and you sit in your cushion and you think about playing basketball and how wonderful it could be and this is the way to do it and if you're successful, this might happen. But this is all great. But once you get on the court and start playing basketball, it becomes embodied. Something's really happening. It's invigorating, it's uplifting. You really know that you're doing something. You're doing something with your body, you're doing something with your mind, and usually when you're playing basketball, you're doing something with your speech. So the same with sadhana practice, that we aspire to benefit beings. We aspire to express ourselves in the world on the basis of wisdom and compassion. But here in our sadhana practice, we have a chance to enact this on a daily basis, to actually do something, to actually imagine that you are yourself in an enlightened form, that your speech is actually wisdom speech, you could say, that your mind is a mind of wisdom. Why not? The rest that we make up about me sitting here as some funky person named Tim, this is just another label. There's nothing particularly real about it. So we can actually use our imagination to come closer to who we really are, that we really are an empty form, an empty wisdom form, that speech is sort of empty sound, that mind is wisdom itself. We can imagine that. And so in so doing, we come closer to the true nature of who we are and who the phenomenal world is that we perceive and that we interact with. And we can really, on a daily basis, put our practice kind of into action. Again, it's inspiring, it's invigorating, it's interesting, and it may even be beneficial. So those are just a few thoughts about the beauty of doing sadhana practice. And Miocin?
Well, thanks, Tim. I think I don't really have a lot to add to that, other than, you know, for myself, just what a surprise it has been to do sadhana practice, and that, you know, coming from being a person who just loved to rest, nature of mind practice, just resting, and it's like never imagining that such a practice where you really bring body, speech, and mind together in the way that you do could be something that would appeal to me. And actually, it feels like such a total practice, you know, where you are bringing together all of these elements, and in doing so, bringing them together from the enlightened perspective, of which, you know, I can certainly see for myself how deeply habituated the unenlightened being is. And so to have a practice that that it's tangible, I think, is how I experience it. It's something visceral. It's something that, you know, really enlivens that sense of potential that's within us. And I, you know, I've always felt like I'm, you know, one of my ideas of how I am is that I'm not a good visualizer. I, you know, just never imagined that I would even stay with doing a practice like this. But, you know, in just listening to Tim talking about it, it's like, you know, just getting into this feeling of play with bringing these elements together. And out of that, just the joy that is in it, you know, just the joy of doing it, because it does, you know, it brings in that aspect of compassion, the bodhicitta. It just brings that all alive in, you know, sometimes I have the sense of it's like, you know, we've done the four immeasurables, and this is just like on steroids or something. You know, it has that way of just enriching, and yet within that, you know, there's the empty essence. You know that, you know, there's nothing to hang on to within it, and that in itself has its own beauty as well. So for me, I just really appreciate this practice. I really appreciate Rinpoche putting together this practice for us, you know, having done White Tara in a longer sadhana, and, you know, just that he has put together this liturgy that just takes us right to the essence in the language of what the practice is pointing to. And you know, just to be able to, and then to have the closeness of, we know him, we, you know, we've been with him, we've had teachings from him. You know, he's so close in some way, and that's something else that I've really appreciated about this, is just that closeness, that sense of connection. And so, in this webinar, I'm sure there's questions that have come if we've been doing the practice. But I'd also really just love to hear from people how it's going for you. You know, just if you feel to, please share just something of the difference or what you're experiencing through doing it. And that's the struggles, because it's not always easy, or at least that's my experience. You know, that sometimes, you know, the images don't come. Sometimes, you know, it feels like, I just want to rest, I just want to rest, I just want to rest. And, you know, other times it's just like such a light sense of beingness with the practice. So just whatever your experience is, it would be great to hear. So I think I'd like to just open it up here to anyone who wants to share their experience or has a question or comment.
Okay. Everyone's being shy at the moment. Oh, here we go. Karen Keith, I'm going to unmute you. Hi, Karen. There you go.
Hi. Yes, took me a second. Thank you. Hi, you guys.
Hi,
so
Karen.
Good to see you. I just thought I'd break the ice and go back to what Tim was saying in the introduction. What has been happening for me with regard to Vajra pride or stable pride is when I'm working with that, I'm imagining myself as White Tara, and then a thought will come in that's sort of like, well, yes, I'm enlightened from the start, but. So there's like this but thought that comes up that is like, but you're not really there yet. You're not, you know, you haven't stabilized nature of mind. You're not this and that. So I think I know the answer as far as dealing with those kinds of thoughts, and that is that just watch them and then let them go, I guess. But I just wondered if you had any suggestions when that doubtful thought comes in as you're working with this. Thank you.
So my response is really just to include that too. You know, it's like from within that space, it's all just manifestations. And that, you know, that thought is as empty in essence as the thought that we are white Tara. And so it's all just a manifestation. And that white Tara can have this thought. Wow.
Yeah.
And for me, a piece that helps me with that is this aspect of play, of lightness, of, yes, this too.
Yeah.
I think it might be like a young boy who is a king or a young girl who is a queen. And everybody says, you're the king or you're the queen. And they grow up and they go, no, I'm not really. I'm just a little kid. I'm not really. And it's just something that, as Mirshan says, it comes and goes. You play with it. And it's just the natural, that's why we practice.
Yes.
Okay. To move with these doubts. And you got it.
Yeah, I got it. Yeah, thank you. Thank you guys very much.
But in your case, Karen, we have other problems, so we can talk later.
Yes, we do. one of my problems right now has a little bit to do with what I feel is a little bit of a schizophrenic practice regimen at the moment, because I've been working with White Tara, but I'm also working with the Maha Mudra online, and I'm still working with some of the Nectar of the Simple Yogi, and so I need to talk with you, Tim, more about that and where I am, and I feel a little schizophrenic, but I'll let other people talk. But I did have a question relating to the Maha Mudra online and incorporating the aspiration of Maha Mudra when you're doing the White Tara practice. Is that something we should do? It's recommended. I'm not wanting to switch gears here, but
sure.
Where do you put the Maha Mudra aspiration?
You could just recite it at the beginning of your practice.
Okay, at the beginning with the daily chants. Okay.
Yeah, it's a beautiful way to remind ourselves of the entire path, essentially, in about 3 minutes. So,
Okay, thank you. All right, thank you, guys. Thanks.
I'm going to unmute Ann Helm. Hi, Ann. Oops. Ann, do you want to unmute yourself?
Yes.
There you go.
I went the wrong direction. Okay, hi. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. I have a couple of questions, and one is about Tara's pure perception, or just the notion of working with the light rays, and whether she ever does like Tonglin, that she's ever pulling, taking away the suffering of beings, or is it that she's in such a pure realm that it's just that there's this abundance of health, happiness, wisdom, so forth, and, as the light rays are, it says in the instructions that the light rays are coming back from the sentient beings, that they have so much merit and cities and so forth. They have got plenty to share with me. And anyway, I'm just wondering if we ever incorporate that notion of taking away suffering, or whether that's just simply on a different level of practice.
I haven't done it in that way, so that's what I can say. There is for me personally that sense of that purity and that abundance, and it's like the blessings of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, and it even when we're doing it to all of the lakes and the oceans and the trees, I mean, it just, that seems to be the level of which this practice is really touching.
Of course, you know, if we think of the Buddha, for instance, the Buddha was completely enlightened and had completely pure view, but the Buddha's expression was compassion. So that pure view actually sees the essence of all circumstance. And because people don't see that same thing, they struggle. Because people don't see themselves as essentially enlightened, they struggle. And so that's why Tara arises, to take away the suffering of beings. Otherwise, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas don't need to get born. So I don't think that there is a contradiction in any way. And in terms of, you know, I think Cortland is hiding in the audience back there somewhere.
I've got his name on there, yeah.
The
yeah.
Chicken that he is. But so he knows the details of these. But I can tell you personally, and maybe I can just tell you personally, that we have plenty of time here. You know, however long we practice, we have plenty of time. We do a day and a day. I think we can be quite creative with it. I think we can imagine light coming out and virtue and merit coming back and offerings to the three jewels and the light healing beings and then taking their suffering. I think anything can happen, actually, because it's all basically just a display. And it's not solid. We're not solid. The activity isn't solid. And so personally, I think we can really be creative with it. But that's just my personal take and from just personal conversations with my teachers.
Okay, good. Yeah, because I was just wondering if whether she's on such a different level of pure perception that she wouldn't even be seeing suffering sentient beings. But you're saying if that like occurs to me as a natural thing to like want to pull away their suffering with those light rays, then that's no problem. I could do that.
I think that, yeah, that's just a place of connecting into the visualization, and that because she's the liberator or liberatress.
Liberatrix.
That out of that, you know, so it's like, you know, for me, it's been that aspect of that seeing of the purity. But, you know, within that, there's that sense of with all beings, you know, the beings in so many different levels of suffering, that in order to do that, there's that alleviation of suffering that happens. And so if that comes to life for you in it, I think I would agree with Tim that that seems really fine.
Yeah.
Okay, good. And may I ask another question? Do either of you have a sense of why the seed syllables face to the left instead of facing to the front? And it seems so wrong to me. I mean, that I've never had before had a Yidam practice where the syllables don't face the same way as the deity is sitting. But they all face to all the single syllables face to the left. And do you have any thoughts about that?
No.
I think we need the background guy on that one.
Well, I have asked him this before, I think, and in an email, but he did mention that he had this in a previous sadhana that was in Longching Ningtig. So it's not like something that Mingyur Rinpoche made up.
Right.
But in all the sadhanas I've ever received instruction about, I've never heard this, that it doesn't go the same way, you know, facing the front. Anyway, it just, I don't know. But yeah. You don't have any idea, just do it. I mean, I can do it, but it's like, it just seems odd. Yeah, if we have a White Tara webinar with Mingyur Rinpoche, I'd really like to be able to ask him to tell us.
Definitely.
If he knows about this. Okay.
That would, all right. It would be great to have a webinar with him. What a good idea.
Okay, I'm finished. Thank you.
Okay, Anne. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm going to unmute Joan Harris. Joan?
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I got a phone going here. So I can appreciate Anne's being able to visualize the seed syllables because I have a hard time visualizing just about anything and everything. And I guess my question is not really about, well, it's about the visualization, but it's also about the dialogue with my own mind about, like, it doesn't really matter, but it does matter. You know, there's the crystal palace and the mind taking the form of the mute potla flower and the radiating rainbow light. And it's just like sometimes I can get a little bit of something, but it's hard. And I don't want to say it doesn't matter, but I don't want to say it really, really does matter and I'm doing just a lousy job. So I'm trying to find that sort of middle way between improving the visualization but not being too hard on myself for not being able to get something going. So I wonder if you have any thoughts about that mind dilemma.
Well, I think, you know, you hit an interesting point, which is to say it doesn't matter or to say it does matter are both sort of extremes. They're sort of us sort of wiggling on the hook or something. Of course, ultimately, it doesn't matter. But to say it doesn't matter is like, okay, forget it. Well, you know, these practices have been offered to us for reasons, and these suggestions have been offered for reasons. So within that, within the middle place there, is where we play. And in terms of visualization, there's a number of ways that visualization is being taught. And in some traditions, the visualization is that the idea is that you become very, very precise, more precise, to the point eventually where the visualization is more real than real. Then in other traditions, it opens it up a little bit. And so, for instance, you know, Tolkujin, when I would ask Tolkujin about this, he would say, just flash the visualization and have the confidence that it's all there. So there's a big sweep here in terms of where to work with this. But one thing that is always helpful to me is to remember that the visualization it's an empty form. It's like Tolkujin used to say, it's like writing faces on balloons. So if we try to visualize, and Mindy Rinpoche uses the word, I think, the better word, imagine. Because visualization has the idea that there is truly something there and we have to somehow hold it in our head. That just to bring it up in our imagination and hold it lightly, because the visualization or the imagination is light. It's an empty form. So I think that takes some of the heaviness out of the whole thing. But those are just some of my thoughts anyway.
Yeah, I think that's basically what's really helped me too. And one aspect that has been really helpful to me is to let the visualization move around a bit, because there was such a tendency to try to hold it. And that just created tension in the mind and grasping at thin air. So by moving it around, you know, a little bit, like moving around the face, moving it around the body, that was really helpful to me.
And also, you know, we have this idea of the visualization as if we're visualizing Tara in a painting. But actually, along with the idea of moving around, it's visualizing ourselves. And so, you know, we move, we shift. And so the whole thing can be, again, like we were saying earlier, more playful, more alive, less static, less prescribed, and just kind of feel your way into it. And it comes and it goes, and probably it's not there more than it is there. But again, this is just training. It's not that we get it perfectly or don't get it perfectly. It's just something we come back to again and again. So easy, more ease.
So does it make sense, as you're talking, I'm thinking, would it make sense to take a part of it out and just spend time on the radiating rainbow light just at some random moment or, you know?
Sure. That's okay. One of the instructions, that actually you can move into various parts of the visualization, move out, take it all in, move in, take pieces of it. Again, you know, again, play and be creative with it. So actually, it makes sense and it's taught that way often.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you, and I'm going to unmute Janine Mandola. Go ahead, Janine.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thanks. So I'm definitely having fun with the sadhana. I usually do it after Nectar of the Path, and I'm just going slowly with it. I like to memorize it, and actually I guess I would just quickly mention that for me personally, I just get so much satisfaction out of doing some of the collaging, and then it just creates a lot of rich visualization opportunities for me. So that just really, really works for me. But the question I had was, as I was working through the liturgy, I found that maybe there was one area that was not yielding quite as easily as the rest of it, in terms of at least having a little bit of meaning. You know, trying to have kind of a middle way with it. I don't feel like I have to understand everything, but I don't want it to just fly by and mean nothing either. So one of the trickier parts was, you know, when I take on the youthful form of immortality. And that was a little hard at first. And at first it actually reminded me of, I think Jim Sandy was the one who brought our attention to this part of, I think, the chariot liturgy, where we basically talk about, you know, basically the nature of mind as being unborn. And I thought that was really cool. And after a while, I kind of felt like I made some peace with that in terms of just the infinite potentiality of everything was kind of how I thought of being unborn. But then when it came kind of to the other end and I had to kind of do something with immortality, you know, that was kind of hard. But I gave it some thought, and I just am sharing that the main way I was able to get to kind of make any kind of sense of that was actually once I kind of dawned on me to kind of connect it to bodhicitta, basically, because at least from my kind of practical point of view, if you're really trying to be immortal, then it's really through other people, you know, and the effect that you could have on the world that kind of at least makes the more kind of literal connection for me. But I'd really welcome any other kind of associations for how you kind of approach, you know, taking on the youthful form of immortality. So I just appreciate anything you had to say about that.
Yeah, I would just say that, first of all, I just really appreciate your grappling with this, because I think that really helps it to come alive for us and to have meaning. And sometimes, you know, things just don't fit so comfortably. And so it's great that you're doing this. And for me, I think on some level, it is that sense of going back to that infinite source of responsiveness of wisdom that expresses through compassion. And, you know, that I think that's what you're pointing to in what you're saying. And so it's that ever-ready responsiveness that is timeless, ageless, that has no boundaries.
Right.
You know, it would be interesting to see what Colin had to say about this, since he translated the book on the subject. But it may be that the youthful form of immortality suggests that the form aspect of Tara is a Sambhogakaya form. It's an expression of the essential empty Dharmakaya aspect. And therefore, it is timeless and changeless. And so the expression is changeless. Does that make sense? So this is not a blood and bone visualization that is given to old age, sickness, and death. That's the you know, that's the karma of the human realm. That's the karma of being embodied in this way. But in this form, it's not like that.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
I keep telling
myself every day that enough of this stuff, over.
Well, I'm quite sure that for myself, that because of this line and doing the practice and then when getting up and looking in the mirror, I will know when I have pure perception because it's always a bit of a shock. That's just on the joking note.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to unmute Jane Tara. Hi, Jane Tara. Jane Tara, you're live. Let's maybe her mic. Oh, there you go. Okay. We still can't hear you. I see her turning her mic on and off. So we'll go to someone else while she tries to figure that out. And I'm going to call on Karen Graham. I just unmuted you.
You can hear me now, right?
Oh, yes. There you go. Thank you, Jane.
I don't know what was happening. I just wanted to say how much I appreciate the flexibility that Mengir has put into this practice for us, the different ways of saying the mantra, the different styles, the you know, form and sound, and I must say that I don't stick to one. I sort of change with it because it seems like when I have to say I just got back from a 30-day retreat of practicing it, and this ability to change, like to imagine, like say, you know, like who, what is the essence? What is the essence of the person who's doing this practice? You know, the emptiness meditation, or to just do the sound, to listen to the mantra, and to have it be very, you know, silent in one's own repetition of it, but actually listening to the primordial sound of it. That was, and that seemed to do something to keep the practice very, very fresh, rather than always doing it in the same way. And I kept reading again and again that little section where Mengir has written, like, if your mind becomes weary, he said, and of course in retreat, I get, yeah, okay, my mind is pretty weary right now, so I'll change the way that I'm doing it. That really did keep it fresh. It keeps the practice on. Some people talk about the learning curve. If you constantly on the learning curve, changing things rather than getting sort of embedded in one way of doing things, it creates more freshness, and it actually, I think, stimulates the mind. So anyway, I just wanted to say how much I appreciate the flexibility in the teaching.
Yeah, really great.
Thank you.
I'm glad you didn't ask a question, because it would have been strange for Tara to ask a question about Tara.
Yeah, it's very strange. You know, Mentor gave me that name, and when I got it, they said it was White Tara and the Liberator. I thought about that quite a bit doing this practice. How did that happen?
That's great. Thank you. Thank you. And Karen Graham, I'm going to try and unmute you now. Your hand was up. If you want to unmute yourself. There you go. Thank you.
Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Thanks for taking my question, and I'd like to express a lot of gratitude for this practice. I think it's been really helpful and, enriching. So my practice has been getting more consistent, so I'm glad about that, Yemi. But the other night I was, it was just last night actually, I was having a couple pretty difficult, just mundane life days. And when I went to do my practice, it was quite early this morning, I just didn't feel it. And I was trying to be Tara and couldn't feel Tara. And really, I closed my eyes for a moment. I thought, no, I just want to be a pupating moth buried in the dirt. And I think probably because I was talking recently to a friend who is a moth scientist, that came up. But so I just tried to unmoth myself a little bit to get out of my chrysalis. And so what I realized was I think I wanted to be in my protective sphere. So I went back to the Taisatuna practice while I was doing my mantra. So quite out of sequence and probably, I don't know. At what point is something you should do and you shouldn't do? But anyway, by kind of putting myself, instead of being in a chrysalis, being in my protective sphere, I was able to resurrect my ideation of being Tara. So I guess my question is, I know that was out of context, and I don't suspect, it's the first time I've done that, I don't suspect I'm going to want to cling to that or, you know, use that as a go-to, but I was just wondering your take on something like that arising in practice and then utilizing it.
Go ahead, Tim.
So could you, I'm not quite sure when you say utilizing it, arising and utilizing it. Say again.
So when I realized, you know, like I said, this idea of, it was just this flash of an idea of, I don't feel Tara, I don't want to be Tara, and I just saw myself as this little brown, like I can imagine the brown moth probably better than I, or the little pupae better than I sometimes can imagine Tara, and you know, that just, and from that I recall the protective sphere from the Taisatupa practice, and so I just started trying, you know, and not a very well-practiced student. I'm a new student, but I have done that practice, so I'm trying to recall, the yellow sphere, and then the red, and then, you know, and so on, and so on, the flowers in between, and so I just worked with that so that I could kind of build up the visualization of Tara, and that seemed to work in that instance. But I guess along the way, there's a little bit of, should I be in this Taisatupa practice? This isn't part of the current sadhana.
I mean, there will be many reruns. There'll be 1,000 things that will come up. You'll feel like this. You won't feel like this. It'll feel good. It won't feel good. All of a sudden, you're Tara. Then you're a Ma. So this is just the play of the mind. I mean, I wouldn't personally, maybe it's because I'm old and lazy, but if something sort of weird comes up in terms of resistance or whatever, I don't think you need to lay on a whole bunch of antidotes to it, like setting up, you know, a protective circle around it or something like that. I think just let it go through and just let it go and just keep coming back to the practice again and again, lightly, loosely. And this changes. I mean, all of these practices, all the practices we do at the end of the day are purification practices. What they're doing is they're purifying our funky ways of understanding our body, speech, and mind. And so, as Mingyur Rinpoche says, you know, very clearly and humorously, when we purify, stuff comes up. That's the sign of something purifying. So we're going to have 1,000 weird, funky things arising right in the middle of the practice. And I don't think that that's in any way contrary to the practice or a problem with the practice. I think that's a result of the practice. So I can say that you know, when I've done long sadhana retreats, I've had, you know, in solitary retreat, I've hit walls and had explosions. It's just part of the practice, and then we just come back and keep going. So I don't think we need to, I would encourage you not to sort of apply a lot of different antidotes to it, other than just let it go as just another empty occurrence of the mind. That's just me.
Okay, thank you.
Does that make sense at all?
Sure. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Miyashin, do you have anything?
No, I don't have anything to add to that.
Okay, thank you, Karen. And I'm going to unmute Lisa Dale Miller. There you go, Lisa, you're live.
Hello, Miyashin. Hi, Tim. Hi, Court. Well, I have to say, I have been doing the sadhana every day since I left the retreat, and it takes me about an hour and a half to get through the whole thing. And Cortland, I think I remembered on the retreat you saying, you know, the longest part should really be the mantra recitation, and it makes me laugh every time I hear him say it. In my mind, I hear Cortland's voice saying this, because for me, from the moment I begin, it is such an integrative, embodied practice. Even the visualization at this point, the mandala, there is actually no separation between my physical body and anything that I'm actually visualizing. There are certain points at which, you know, the dome of the crystal palace is actually my skull, and the mandala is all the neurons. And I feel such intimacy with this practice and with Tara herself, especially the wisdom aspect of Tara, which, Miyoshin, this is the white deity. That's who she was. So my question really, I'm having a lot of subtle body integrative experience with this sadhana. You know, I practiced Gyaltsen Tigle for many years, and so I have a lot of experience with sadhana. But this sadhana, the nature of mind, quote unquote, reality and unreality is so visceral for me that it's starting to have a dramatic impact on how actually I'm functioning in my life. I found that the mantra recitation aspect has opened my heart in a way none of the practices that I've ever done in my entire life has opened me this way. And I feel like I'm with Minja Rinpoche the entire hour and a half, really. I mean, it's literally his voice when I do the liturgy. And because I've been doing this now for, you know, so many months, the liturgy is memorized at this point, so I can easily move in and out of the visualization and the liturgy. It's all, I don't know, I'm having a very integrated experience. It's not something I've experienced before with sadhana. So I feel like I'm in a territory that's completely new. And maybe none of this sounds like something unusual to you, but it feels very unusual to me.
Yeah, so when you say that it's affecting your functioning in your life, how are you finding that?
So the compassion,
yeah,
is reality in my life now.
Okay.
It wasn't so much that it was only conceptual, but I have to say it was an effort. You know, it was effortful compassion, and now it's just an aspect of how I'm being in my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it sounds fine, and just keep seeing the empty nature of all of it. And that, you know, some practices, and at times in practice, I mean, and that's where, you know, it could change too, but just really allowing it to unfold in the way it is while seeing the empty nature.
So there isn't really a problem, not that there would be, but there is no visualizing anything outside of myself. I don't really know how to describe this. Everything is so integrated. It's not some image that's out there and I'm here doing this practice. It's there's no separation. Everything is just appearance.
Okay, so if everything is just appearance, can the appearance be other beings?
When I'm doing the practice?
Yeah.
Or in my life?
When you're doing the practice.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Why would that be? Why would other beings be anything different than anything else that might show up during the visualization?
Well, I'm just trying to get a better picture of your experience. That I was clarifying for my own understanding.
So there's vividness,
mm-hmm.
visualization, and yet it's not separate. It's not there's not some Tara out there that I'm visualizing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not some person here that.
And yet it still has form.
All of it has form, and yet it has no form. So the boundary between form and formlessness is becoming less firm. And yet everything maintains its vividness. So it's not as though there's unclarity.
Yeah, I just think keep practicing.
Definitely, I'm going to keep practicing. It's wonderful.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know, Tim, if you have anything to add.
I just have one small thought, and that it's something that I've heard Mingyur Rinpoche talk about many, many times, which is to the end of keeping the practice fresh. I'm not sure the right word. Let it go. Continue to let it go. Disown it in a way. And then come back to it. Particularly when it gets really delicious and really interesting. He would say, and he's said many, many times, break the practice. Like in the middle of the practice. If it really becomes quite interesting and quite vivid, actually stop for a couple of minutes. Because then when we come back to it, it can be actually more fresh yet. So that's just something that I've heard my teachers say many times. Because you are having experience and your practice is very vivid and it's visceral and embodied, like you're saying. So now is the time to begin to play with that instruction. It's not the time... For many of us, when we're just sort of messing with it and having a hard time approaching it, that's not necessarily the instruction. But here, this is when we begin to learn to let it go again and again so that when it returns, it's completely fresh and it's not ours. So that's just an idea.
No, I love that, Tim. I'm like a nyam detective. I'm always on myself after so many years of my teachers always saying, okay, fine. You know, let it go. I'm like a neon detective. I'm always very mindful in the practice whether or not I'm getting lost in some meditative experience, and usually I break the practice and I rest in nature of mind, and I don't have a problem with that, especially with the Tara. This is why it's blowing my mind so much, because nature of mind is always there in this practice. It's almost as though it's a choice whether to go with something or not. So I really appreciate that advice yeah. so much. Thank you.
Yeah, great. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have about 7 minutes left, and there have been 6 questions that have been submitted in written form, and there's no other hands raised, so I'll start with Catherine Goldman Schuler's question. She says, I feel at ease and nourished by the visualization approach to the mantra, but wanted to follow the directions, so began trying the speech methods. Suddenly, my sense of being drawn to the practice lessened. The amount of time I practiced decreased. I've been able to increase it again some, but it still feels more like pushing myself uphill. And focusing on the wheel seems like a visualization to me. So she has a 3-pronged question here. One, I've never been taught these 3 approaches to mantra recitation, and could you explain more about that now and about their nature and importance? And 2, is it important to do the number of hours assigned of each approach, even if one feels at home with one particular approach? And 3, how is it still the word approach if it involves visualizing? And I can repeat those if you like.
Well, I'll speak to one piece of it, and that is that when we do this practice, we are using our minds in different ways, and that for many of us, we may not be, you know, feel so adept at visualization, that aspects of it may not be just as easy as it has been just resting in nature of mind or just resting. And so there can be real value in, you know, it's like stretching ourselves a little bit so that it becomes more fully embodied. And in doing that, that we do need to have balance with that. So if, you know, if we're, the practice is getting so hard that we throw it away, then no, it can be better to shift to keep it fresh, shift to another aspect of the practice. And that's beautiful that this practice is so multifaceted in that way. But that by doing that, by shifting around a little bit, we can stay connected to it. And so I do think that there's real value in even doing it when it can be challenging at times. And, you know, I could have given up on visualization in the beginning. You know, it would have been just so easy for me to think, I cannot do this. This is not my inclination. And it's not my most natural inclination. But it's been, you know, amazing to watch over time how that shifted. And, it, you know, it feels like, you know, just having a muscle in the body that we've never used. And we discover it, and it's like, oh, how did we ever not know it was there? And then as we, you know, begin to play with it, we begin to see, oh, it helps our body to move in a whole nother way. And, you know, that to me is just incredibly valuable. And it is like learning to do something you didn't know you could do. So that's what I would say about that. I don't know, Tim?
Yeah, I think that's the important point. This is training. So sometimes it feels great, sometimes it's easy, and sometimes it's not so easy because we're trying to shift a perception, a lifetime after lifetime perception that's inaccurate. So in order to change it, it's going to take time, and sometimes it feels good, and sometimes it feels like a push, and sometimes we feel like doing it, and sometimes we don't, and I think that's just all part of training. So the idea of pushing myself up, oneself uphill, I don't take that necessarily as a bad thing. I think that's where the practice of joyful endeavor, joyful exertion comes in, that we actually rouse ourselves and say, okay, this is an opportunity in this life, and come back to it again and again. So I think by definition, difficulties come up. That's why we practice. And these really subtle practices really flesh out all of the difficulties, resistance, the frustration. So I think just keep coming back. And as Mirshan said, to build other kinds of muscles, other kinds of capability, and So it sounds perfect. Maybe, Diane, let's leave it at that, because I think that was the main thing.
Okay. So Lisa Lanting submitted a question. I would like to keep doing this practice instead of Nectar of the Path levels. Is that possible?
Mission, is that possible?
No. You know, I think there is clearly a path that Mingyur Rinpoche is laying out for us, and that at the retreat, the Waitara retreat, he had encouraged people who hadn't, you know, done the completion of the Nectar of the Path to continue on with that. And I think there is real value in that there are so many aspects that we're working with in Nectar of the Path that will help the Tara practice to really come to fruition. And, you know, that it can make it, help it give wings to it, in a sense. And so I think that there is a value. And so, of course, like, if you could be doing Nectar of the Path, and then sometimes you're doing White Tara, which helps keep you inspired. But the basis of Nectar of the Path, I think it is really good to complete that, as has been laid out by Rinpoche. Yeah.
Very clear. And Maura Pegler asks, when resting in nature of mind during practice, how important is it to keep track of being White Tara and of the practice?
So I think this is a really important question, and it's an interesting question, that when we're resting in the nature of mind always has an expression. So the White Tara practice is the expression of mind's nature. It's its natural radiance, you could say. So that we never rest in the nature of mind in the absence of something occurring to us. So in fact, so much so that Mingyur Rinpoche says that in those guidelines that that are in the sadhana, he said that the visualization is an empty and an ungraspable, like a pristine clarity of the open sky. Reciting mantra while resting in the nature of mind is the union of development and completion stage. It is the supreme practice. So I think that we never separate those. I think you wouldn't want to try to separate those. Sometimes, you know, it all drifts away, and that's fine. But don't think of them as separate things, I guess is the point. It's like if the nature of mind is the mirror is always having reflections. That's what mirrors do. So nature of mind is always reflecting something. So they're never, the empty aspect is never separated from the clarity aspect. And in this case, the practice and the visualization and the mantra are the clarity aspect.
And Joy Baum asked a question that Myoshin kind of touched on in her answer to Lisa. She said, how to seamlessly integrate this practice with other daily practices?
Yeah, so, you know, if we are at the point of doing White Tara, then I think, you know, in our opening chants that we can include different pieces, but that, again, I think it's really good to devote ourselves to this practice and to really take it on in a certain way. And, you know, one of the things that I've seen in my own mind, and somebody used the phrase early on in this, getting schizophrenic about what we're doing. And when I find that, you know, I'm going to this practice, that practice, this practice, it's like, wait a minute. You know, it's all, in one sense, within one practice. And to really feel out what each practice has to offer us, I think, is incredibly valuable. So I don't think that we need to try to be doing too many different practices at one time. And that I would go on the side of simplicity with that. Like, there is, you know, pieces like what Tim, I think, had said earlier about doing the Mahamudra aspiration prayer, that you know, the simple things like that can easily, that, you know, just really remind us why we're doing what we're doing. But then let the practice work itself.
Thank you. Katie Mitchell said, I shift from concentration to awareness of the practice. Is this okay? I've previously practiced jhana in Burma.
Okay. Is Katie on? I would just like to ask a question there to fully...
Yeah, she's not. She's okay. Not.
Okay, so it's hard for me to... No, having if you because of your jhana practice, I'm just really not clear about what that when you're saying concentration, what your experience might be there, because sometimes in jhana practice it can be so one-pointed, and that I think what we're speaking about here is a different kind of one-pointedness. So I'm just not really clear what your experience is. So I'd love to be able to answer your question, and maybe you could write me an email and I'd be happy to respond.
And the last question
there's
is...
There's one tip about that, though. Also, remember that first of all, you know... Anyway, Mission, you can address the concentration thing, but the visualization and the mantra, these are all empty forms and empty sounds. You can't concentrate too much on something that is an empty form. So the whole thing is, you know, the emphasis is to loosen our grip on sounds and thoughts and forms altogether, and that becomes closer and closer to enlightened body, speech, and mind. When it's open, when it's mixed with spaciousness and emptiness. That's why we're practicing this, is to come to that quality of open and spacious, clear body, speech, and mind. Yeah.
So the final questions from Marianne Kramer Ames. Can supplicating the deity cause a transmission to take place? If so, can you explain transmission and how it works?
Well, that's a...
That's a good question.
So I think just in short, and this would be a great question to ask Mingyur Rinpoche at some point, because he speaks about this very beautifully. But supplicating a deity is really what the heart of supplication is, a heart of devotion. And when the heart and mind are open in that way, open, receptive, then mind shifts. That's what we can, sometimes transmission means many things, but that's when blessings occur. And blessings have the effect of changing your outlook, of stopping your mind and changing your outlook. And so this can be supplicating the deity, supplicating the guru, but this is the essential power of devotion. And so Mingyur Rinpoche says, you know, everything has a certain amount of kind of power. So water has the power to dissolve things. Heat has the power to burn things. This quality of devotion has a certain kind of power. And the result of that is to open mind yet further and shift our perception. So I think that's what Marianne is maybe getting at here, but I'm not sure.
Well, we've come to the end of our time, so thank you so much. If you have any closing words.
Yes, good night. But thank you, everybody. And Max, thank you so much for what you've done for years to support us and make this all possible. And Diane, yet again, thank you for hosting this webinar. And Mieshin, thanks for doing this together. This has been a lot of fun.
Yes.
And everybody back there, who's all of you who are practicing White Tara and who are just interested in all of this crazy stuff and the path in general, I really appreciate everybody's interest, and it's fun to chat, and let's do it again.
Yeah.
Mieshin, any?
Wonderful to hear from people how your practice is going and how the places we struggle I so appreciate that we can come together as community in this way and learn from each other. And may we all just keep practicing for the benefit of all beings. And thank you.
Thanks everybody.